Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
President Donald Trump's pick for the U.S. Department of Education wants to usher in more school choice, but critics say the policies undermine public schools, and Florida may be a case in point.
We've got a problem whether she's confirmed or not. It's time for us to take a look at what we've done. It's overdue.
Also this week, families who rely on medical cannabis are hoping state officials keep them top of mind as they implement Amendment 2.
Just normal, regular people with sick kids and sick family members that aren't there to abuse the system, that just want better quality of life.
We'll also learn about a push to do away with the higher taxes on products that women mostly buy and how changes in public entertainment preferences have finally caught up with the greatest show on earth. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. President Donald Trump's pick to head the Department of Education is a conservative fundraiser and vocal critic of traditional public schools. While Betsy DeVos's nomination could mean drastic change for some states, Kate Payne reports she's already made her mark on Florida's education system.
Betsy DeVos isn't an educator, but the experience she does have is in states like Florida, where she used her family's fortune to steer policy away from traditional public schools. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana joked about this reputation at her confirmation hearing.
Do you support public education?
Absolutely, Senator.
Man, that's amazing. You would think some would have us think that you do not.
DeVos is a vocal advocate and fundraiser for the school choice movement. These policies free students to leave the schools they're zoned for and go to private or charter schools, taking tax dollars with them. One of her main cheerleaders is former Governor Jeb Bush, who upended the state's public schools with financial support from DeVos and others. He ushered in high-stakes testing for grading students and teachers, and he implemented the first statewide voucher program, which lets students use public money for private school. Patricia Levesque heads Bush's Foundation for Excellence in Education.
Parents need, the ability to pick the right school or system or services that will really meet their child's needs.
But opponents of the school choice movement say these policies undermine public schools. Unsurprisingly, one of the loudest critics is the state's teachers union, the Florida Education Association. Mark Pudlow is the group's spokesman.
We have a very accountable public school system with testing and grades and this and that. And the private voucher schools don't have to have any of those things. They don't have to follow the curriculum. They don't have to have the testing regimen. They don't have to hire certified teachers.
DeVos's administration likely won't mean drastic change for Florida, unlike those states where vouchers and charters are illegal. But it's still not clear how she'll come down on accountability and privatization, namely allowing more for-profit control of charter schools. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia questioned her during the confirmation hearing.
Will you insist upon that equal accountability in any K-12 school or educational program that receives federal funding, whether public, public charter, or private?
I support accountability.
Equal accountability for all schools that receive federal funding.
I support accountability.
Okay, is that a yes or no?
I support accountability.
Do you not want to answer?
North Florida Senator Bill Montford is a retired educator and heads the state's School Superintendents Association. He says he's not overly concerned about DeVos's nomination, but he has seen the long-term effects of school choice in his own district, where the Jefferson County schools are on the verge of closing.
So what we have not done is to assess the impact of choice on the entire program. A lot of Jefferson County's problems, the school districts there, are the results of the options that parents and schools and districts have been given.
School choice advocates say wealthy students are already opting into private schools, and it's only fair to give poorer students a shot as well, hence the vouchers. But with each exiting student goes tax dollars and political capital, leaving some of the most vulnerable behind. Montford asks, what about those who can't leave?
Well, sure, they can choose, but they can't activate that choice because they don't have the means to do it. They may want to choose to come to Leon County to go to school, but if they don't have transportation, they can't do it. So they really don't have choice.
If Florida lawmakers are going to head further down the school choice path, Montford says they should look deeply at cases like Jefferson County, where the promise of choice for all is an empty one. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
The Florida Department of Health and a Republican state senator are offering drastically different visions for the future of medical cannabis in the state. Nick Evans reports it could set the stage for a contentious rollout of last year's Amendment 2.
This month, state regulators unveiled their plan for implementing Amendment 2. And in about 2 weeks, they'll take the show on the road, holding public hearings in four cities across the state. They're likely to get an earful when they do.
They basically, you know, ignored a lot of the text of the amendment in writing this rule and tried to fit it within the confines of an existing law versus recognizing that the Constitution trumps statute and they should be fitting the previous law into the new confines of the broader constitutional amendment.
That's Ben Pallera, head of Florida for CARE and one of Amendment 2's authors. Rather than taking definitive steps forward in line with the amendment, the department's initial rule looks back to the existing statutory framework. The rule changes definitions, not policy. Dispensing organizations become medical marijuana treatment centers. Legal representatives fill the role of caregivers. Requirements for qualifying physicians, well, they're the same as they've always been.
Literally every, you know, section, every bullet of their rule takes a term that is defined in the constitutional amendment and changes its meaning to be the definition that exists in the statute.
But it is a first draft, and Gray Robinson attorney Richard Blau chalks up the department's reticence to its traditional relationship with the legislature.
Amendment 2 comes along and says, build a bigger system. But the legislature hasn't yet given its direction on what that's supposed to look like or how it's going to happen. So under these circumstances, as a normal course in the whole context of how administrative agencies work, the agency would really, you know, hold off in large part until it received direction from the legislature.
And just 2 days after releasing his draft rule, the department got a preview of where the legislature may be headed. Senator Rob Bradley, a Republican from Port Orange who's led on cannabis issues in the past, filed a measure establishing benchmarks for adding new growers, opening up the role of caregiver, and ensuring patients can continue receiving treatment while the agency works out regulations. For Rosalind Eckerhoff, one of the most important proposed changes has to do with physicians.
Because as it stands right now, patients have to have a relationship with their physician, with a physician, a qualified physician, for 90 days before they can have access to medical cannabis. And again, you wouldn't do that with any other medication. If you went in for high blood pressure or whatever, you would get your medicine that day.
Deckerhoff's son Barrett has autism and epilepsy, and they treat his seizures with low THC cannabis. Bradley's proposal removes the 90-day requirement and gives physicians greater leeway in recommending treatment. But it's still early days for the Bradley bill. The road ahead could be rocky, just as it has every time cannabis legislation has come up in recent years. Deckerhoff recognizes the challenge ahead and says she and her family will keep working to educate Floridians about the drug.
We want to just be kind of the face of who needs medical cannabis. And it's people with sick family members, just normal, regular people with sick kids and sick family members that aren't there to abuse the system, that just want better quality of life.
The Department of Health will hold its first public workshop in Jacksonville, February 6th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a small North Florida town is taking a gamble on slot machines. Officials say they may be the economic driver needed to help the community grow.
Where else do you harness folks' ideas about creating a business right here at home? I mean, it's taken away because there's no money here.
Florida seems to have more young people today than it has young lawmakers to represent them. We'll talk with a 21-year-old student who became a lawmaker.
You know, just because my age is below that average, I don't think that being an outlier is a negative thing. I think that it's honestly a strength.
And we'll look into an unlikely area that we'll be working to conserve, the gopher tortoise population. Gambling is shaping up to be a major legislative issue this year. A bill filed in the state Senate touches nearly every aspect of the industry, from fantasy sports to greyhound racing. And each of those issues carries its own set of implications. For some, it's about finding more money to fund state projects. For others, it's about entertainment or spending time with friends. And as Regan McCarthy reports, for those living in the city of Gretna, it's about jobs and a path towards stability.
The city of Gretna is one of those blink-and-you-miss-it kind of towns. It's got a few convenience stores, a liquor store, and acres of farmland stretching on each side of the city limits.
While all of the remainder of the state is seeing some improvements in their local economies, the rural areas of Florida are seeing a decline.
Antonio Jefferson is the city's manager. He says the city's looking for a way out of what seems to be a vicious cycle. Kids grow up, need jobs, can't find them, and leave. That leaves Gretna with an aging population, unattractive to businesses and young professionals. Jefferson says the city needs to find a way to keep young people there to work and grow the economy.
So our employment center is in Tallahassee, it's government jobs, and if we look at what's happening in government, you know, there is a greater demand or expectation now from taxpayers for government to do more with less. So if you remove that opportunity, where else are people left to be, right? Where else do you put that energy, that positive energy? Where else do you harness folks' ideas about creating a business right here at home? I mean, it's taken away because there's no money here.
But Gretna officials have plans. They include an expansion of Creek Entertainment in Gretna. It's a local paramutual that offers horse races as well as simulcast events and poker. Several years ago, Gadsden County residents passed a referendum to allow the facility to operate slot machines as well. Jefferson estimates the move could mean 1,000 more jobs for the area. But so far, no slot machines have been installed. That's because the state issuing a permit for the machines has far greater implications than a few jobs and a little more gambling in a small rural town.
When Gretna drops the first coin in a slot machine, the remaining $130, $140 million from the Seminole Tribe will be shut off.
Mark Dunbar is a gambling law attorney who works for the Tallahassee law firm Jones Walker. He's talking about the money the state gets from the Seminole Indian Tribe in exchange for a certain degree of exclusivity. The state and tribe agree to the rules of that exclusivity through what's called a gaming compact. Part of the agreement expired last year, the part dealing with games like blackjack. But if cities like Gretna were allowed to begin operating slot machines, nearly the whole deal would become void, and the money the state gets from the tribe would dry up. This legislative session, lawmakers are looking to rework the deal, and Senate President Joe Negron says he'd like to find a way to include municipalities with referendums like Gretna.
If voters in any particular county approve more gaming opportunities, I think we should respect the decision of those citizens in those communities.
A major gaming overhaul bill is expected to come up in a Senate committee Wednesday, but leaders in the House are taking a tougher stand. While they're attracted to the idea of a new compact agreement to help plug looming budget holes, many House lawmakers insist any new deal must lead to a reduction in gaming. In the end, though, the decision may be out of their hands. The Supreme Court is weighing whether Gretna and similar counties should be allowed to operate slots. A ruling in Gretna's favor could upend any future deal with the Seminole Tribe. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Women have gained more financial power in recent years, but they're still paid less than men. And as technology makes it easier to comparison shop, women in Florida and across the country are realizing they're paying more at the checkout counter. We got that story from Sarah Mueller.
Hi. One trip to the grocery store shows that items like razors, deodorant, and shampoo have different prices depending on who it's marketed to. And it doesn't stop there. From clothes to vehicle maintenance, women are charged more. The pink tax refers to gender-based pricing. Studies reveal products marketed to women, like a pink-colored razor, can cost up to 50% more than a similar one in blue. Some say it's outright discrimination against women. But others, including retailers and manufacturers, say they're pricing products based on the consumer's willingness to pay, and products that seem identical are actually not. Luke Hopkins, assistant director of Florida State University's marketing department, says the pink tax is real, but also controversial.
And what makes the pink tax so difficult to just nail down, and why there is so much debate about it, is a lot of argument can be made for the differences in which people make decisions.
Gender-based pricing compounds the problem of the wage gap. Women have less money to start with. Julie Anderson of the Institute for Women's Policy Research says about 23% of working single mothers in Florida live in poverty. Over half of Florida families have a working mother.
It just seems like while the wage gap is just about money you take home, when we look at expenses and see that, you know, also disadvantaged in the expense column, that just sort of adds insult to injury.
While not directly tackling pricing disparities, some state lawmakers are working to help Florida women get some economic equality. Florida Senator Kathleen Pasadomo, a Naples Republican, wants to exempt feminine hygiene products from sales tax.
We're paying a sales tax on something that is an absolute necessity, and yet because of a public policy of trying to foster, you know, business growth and development, we're reducing sales tax on a lot of things that are important to business.
And Tampa Democrat Representative Janet Cruz wants to exempt diapers and baby wipes.
I was a former teen mother myself, and I understand the challenges and the financial hardships that can come from raising a child, especially when you're still trying to go to school or you're working on minimum wage. And
more women are becoming aware of the price differences because it's so easy to compare prices online. But Luke Hopkins, the FSU professor, says some price differences is companies setting the highest price they think a consumer is willing to pay. He says, generally, women care more about their physical appearances than men, so they're willing to pay more for things like shampoo, which cost women 48% more than men's shampoo.
At the end of the day, I care much less about my hair than say my wife cares about hers. And not to say that that's the case with all people, but to make a generalization, I think what these companies that price and manufacture hair care products have realized is that, you know, women are more concerned with their hair and therefore will pay what might be considered a price premium.
13 other states aren't taxing tampons. Some, like California and Massachusetts, have laws against gender-based pricing for certain services. New York City has a similar rule on their books. But determining gender discrimination from pricing reflecting consumer choice remains a tricky prospect. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
A changing of the guard in Washington, D.C. overshadowed another sign of the times in Florida this week, the announcement that Manatee County-based Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus will end performances in May. As Jim Ash reports, animal rights activists are elated as the 146-year-old entertainment icon based in Manatee County falls victim to changing tastes and market conditions.
Many saw the end coming in May, when the greatest show on earth permanently retired its elephants to a Polk County Conservation Center. But animal rights activists say the seeds of destruction were really sown in 2013 with the debut of Blackfish, a documentary about a troubled orca and the death of a SeaWorld trainer in Orlando. Here's how Gabriella Kaupferweit described her film's message to CNN.
What we could do with these captive animals is essentially, you know, stop the world of animals for entertainment, which is essentially the circus, right? We need to evolve past that.
After ticket sales plunged, SeaWorld announced it was ending its captive breeding program and pulling the curtain on killer whale performances in 2019. The Ringling Brothers' demise is only the next logical step, says Kate McFall, Florida State Director for the Humane Society of the United States.
This is the way society is going. You don't have to be cruel to animals to make money. In fact, just the opposite. If you're more humane and your business model is more humane-minded, people want that.
But Feld Entertainment spokesman Stephen Payne says the primary reason Ringling is shutting down is math, not protesters.
Some of them have been taking a victory lap, but the truth about this is there are no winners here. There was not one particular cause that gave rise to this decision. It was a myriad of reasons.
Company officials say it's harder for Ringling Brothers to draw crowds without their signature elephant acts. Ticket sales no longer justify rising travel and production costs for two shows and more than 500 employees, Payne says. Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus predates human flight, not just the internet, Payne says, adding that tastes have changed and attention spans have all but evaporated.
I can't think of any other form of, you know, entertainment, or that many brands for that matter, that lasted 146 years. I mean, Ringling Brothers is older than Coca-Cola and the Kentucky Derby. But you're right, tastes do change over time.
But the Humane Society's Kate McFall says the public is simply too enlightened to enjoy seeing animals in cages.
So many people these days realize the cruelty involved and the life of confinement and sadness that the animals endure. It's just not, it's not something people want to support anymore.
According to a company announcement, the final performances will be at the Dunkin' Donuts Center in Providence, Rhode Island on May 7th and Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum in Uniondale, New York on May 21st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
From March 5th to May 7th, Florida lawmakers will debate proposals on a host of issues like college affordability and health care access during the annual legislative session. But who are the lawmakers making the decisions to shape Florida's future? More specifically, are millennials, or people the Census Bureau defines as born between 1982 and 2000, proportionately represented in the Florida legislature? The data suggests not really. Joseph Ceballos Roik has the story.
Millennials are now America's largest generation, but a recent survey found they are vastly underrepresented in state legislatures, including Florida. That's according to a survey by Stateline and the National Conference of State Legislatures. The report says the age disparity could fuel a disconnect between young voters and the institutions of government. In Florida, millennials make up over a quarter of the state population, yet they hold just 10% of the legislature's 160 seats. The average age of a Florida legislator? 51.
You know, just because my age is below that average, I don't think that being an outlier is a negative thing. I think that it's honestly a strength, because people will be looking to me for things that affect our youth.
That was University of Central Florida junior Amber Mariano. In November, she became the youngest person elected to the Florida legislature. She's 21. Mariano feels confident that she can bring a new perspective in the legislature on issues facing Florida's millennials, particularly in the area of college affordability. One Mariano proposal would increase the number of credit hours an in-state student can take before facing a 100% tuition surcharge, and another would allow Bright Future scholarships to be used to cover summer tuition costs. Despite Mariano's win, major hurdles remain for young people aspiring to enter politics.
It costs quite a bit to campaign, even if it's just something so simple as passing out brochures, or, you know, creating bumper stickers or something to get your name out there, or even if you try to go the cheap route and advertise on radio.
Susan McManus is a professor of political science at the University of South Florida. She says part of the reason millennials are underrepresented in government has to do with the vast amount of time needed to gain political experience. They don't have it. Campaigns are expensive, and millennials are broke. They also lack name recognition that historically depends on giving speeches before Rotary clubs or gaining the support of organizations like the League of Women Voters.
And a student that, or a young person just graduating, that thinks they can just immediately announce and do well without getting some experience and some familiarity with people in your district is really not realistic.
In Mariano's case, McManus said, she benefited from the name recognition that came with being the daughter of Pasco County Commissioner Jack Mariano. McManus sees another growing problem among young people, political cynicism. She says it is driven by a perception that money and special interests have excessive influence in politics, which polls have shown are sources of concern among younger voters.
I would say that government corruption is more subtle than it has been in the past.
I definitely think that the government's getting corrupt, just more corrupt every day.
So it seems to me that we don't have people who are, you know, fighting for our rights in government, but instead fighting for the rights of businesses or foreign powers.
Those were FSU students Thomas Payne, Hagen Gary, and Will Leach speaking last September ahead of an appearance by conservative provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos. McManus.
You're starting to see a higher cynicism about the two-party system among younger voters than other age groups. That's why in our state, for example, the highest incidence of younger voters voting for either Jill Stein or Gary Johnson, it was highest among young voters.
Representative Mariano, however, is optimistic about the future. She says other young legislators before her have helped pave the way for young people to enter state politics. For example, fellow Republican Representative Jennifer Sullivan and State Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam were elected to the Florida House in their early 20s. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Joseph Zeballos-Roich.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, when you think of gopher tortoise conservation efforts, what's the first place that comes to mind? What about a military base? As Sasha Cordner reports, Eglin Air Force Base in the Panhandle is partnering with national and state wildlife officials on a massive effort to help relocate hundreds of the threatened species.
Hi, I'm Andrea.
And I'm Keen. And we're here to tell you about gopher tortoises!
That's one of the promotional videos via the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission to get more people, even kids, involved in protecting gopher tortoises. The FWC also has other efforts underway to encourage gopher tortoise conservation. Alex Calfin is with the FWC's Gopher Tortoise Conservation Program.
By increasing or improving gopher tortoise habitat, there's 362 commensal species that rely on the gopher tortoise burrow for either survival or to escape predators or extreme temperatures.
FWC also partnered with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Eglin Air Force Base to relocate at least 500 gopher tortoises over the next year to the military base in the Panhandle. Primarily from Central Florida, the gopher tortoises will come from different areas across the state slated for development. So why Eglin Air Force Base? Eglin is not only one of the largest Air Force bases in the U.S., it has thousands of acres of forest land. And Justin Johnson, an Eglin wildlife biologist, says the base has been doing similar conservation efforts like this for more than three decades. Whether it's helping the red-cockaded woodpecker or the Okaloosa darter, a type of small fish. In fact, Johnson says thanks to Eglin's efforts, federal wildlife officials changed the Okaloosa darter's endangered status.
And there are a lot of species that are put on the list, but very rarely do they ever get downlisted or taken off the list.
Now, Jeremy Preston, Eglin's endangered species biologist, says they hope the gopher tortoise relocation effort goes well to create what's considered a minimum viable population, or 250 adult gopher tortoises.
We're building towards our first viable population of 250 animals. And so far, we've received about 100 of those.
An Eglin spokesman, Mike Spate, says these conservation efforts not only aid the gopher tortoises as well as other species that benefit from their underground burrows, it also helps the Air Force Base by providing more flexibility to conduct different military exercises.
But we're not just indiscriminately, you know, dropping bombs and missiles and guns throughout that. It's very specific small areas.
And Spate says the gopher tortoises will be placed in non-public areas safely away from the military exercises. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport, and please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.